Good evening, everyone. So it's good to have many of you back, a few new faces as well. It's good to have you with us too. So I think what we have to do is a little bit of chazara, a little bit of review. Toby can't hear me.
No, can you hear me now?
Yeah, perfect.
Yes.
Okay, I had to restart my computer.
Wonderful. Glad to
It
have you
was
with us, Toby.
my problem.
Do we have an appropriate case to display that cup?
Appropriate case. I think it
Toby,
was
I
in.
don't know. I'll have to see what the new plans show. I don't know. I hope so.
It was in Matt's office this whole year because we won for the past 6 consecutive years. So I think when the
Yeah.
new offices are done, God willing, we'll find an appropriate place to display our trophy.
Oh, maybe in
For
the
those coming
lobby.
in
Maybe
late,
in the
Agudashov
lobby.
won the softball
Well,
game
I'm gonna
today
be
in
in
Prague,
there.
Israel. Anyway, okay. So we had our fun with some baseball today. Let's move on to some Torah. So let me share the source sheet with all of us. I think this is the right one. I have two Onas Dvarim sheets open. That's what confused me because I'm hoping to write up what we are learning together into an essay at some point. So I've been working on that in some spare time. So what did we do last time? This, God willing, will be our final shiur where we're talking about the question of political correctness, sensitivity, freedom of speech, and how Judaism interfaces and would approach these kind of questions that come up today. So just a very, let's do a, the recap gets longer each time, but just to orient ourselves. So we start off with our question, which was, if Reuven says something to Shimon, and the term that Reuven uses offends Shimon, is it incumbent upon Reuven to alter the way he speaks to accommodate Shimon's sensitivities? So the part one that we did in our first class, we just went into the general halachic parameters of onas dvarim. Onas dvarim is a word I won't translate so frequently, so just remember this. Onas dvarim means to harm someone emotionally, usually in a verbal manner. So to harm someone verbally slash emotionally. That is onas dvarim. And so we looked at the Gemara through, which gave a number of examples. Calling someone by a nickname they don't like is a good example. That came up in Tainus. Rambam mentioned as well, if you call someone out on not knowing something and you humiliate them that way, that also is onas dvarim. And then we talked about how severe it is that according to the Mordechai, you actually get makos if you're indicted for it. You could get lashes for it. So that's how severe it is. But then we mentioned, even though onas dvarim seems to be applicable in so many places and so severe, we mentioned a very significant limitation. So what was that significant limitation? That if you don't have kavana to do it, you don't have intent to harm someone, then you might be putter. But then, so we sharpened what that meant. We distinguished between awareness versus intention. So our case is where I'm actually, it's a middle ground case where I'm aware I'm harming someone, but I'm not intending to harm them with that word per se. So one example we used, which was a less political example, but a very commonplace and accepted one, which is someone says special needs child, but now it is important to, many people say it's important to use person first language. So we say child with special needs. So in that case, if someone uses the term special needs child, let's say they don't mean to intend any emotional harm to the listener. But that's just how they're used to talking and they don't want to bother changing it. So we said it may be problematic, it may not be problematic. And we learned through a few Gemaras that, especially a Gemara that talked about trauma as well, that lended itself as a proof one way. We won't go back into that in detail. Then, most previously, what we did in our last class together last week, we mentioned that there are a few exceptions to the rule of onas dvarim. So the Rama has a very ambiguous line. He says, "Umishema anes atzmo mutter lo niho." Someone who causes ona, causes some form of emotional distress to himself, it's mutter to cause ona to them. We were perplexed by that line because you would think, if I punch myself in the face, does that give you permission to punch me in the face? No, that's not logical. So then, why is it logical that if someone is self-deprecating in an unhealthy way, that is all of a sudden permissible for you to do that to them? If anything, you need to be more careful not to cause onas dvarim to someone who's in that very difficult, precarious position. So what we offered a few interpretations of the Rambam, and the important one that we're going to be focusing on this evening is the interpretation based on the Gemara. So we have to look at a few sources just to reorient ourselves. The Gemara in Bava Metzia says that, why does it say in the verse, "V'lo sanu ishes amiso," that a man shall not cause onah, shall not cause emotional distress to someone from his people, from his nation? It means to tell us that someone who is with you in Torah and mitzvos, they you are not allowed to cause onas tvarim to, but anyone else, it's fair game, at least on a strict biblical level. So what does it mean not to be with part of the nation in Torah and mitzvos? Does that mean if I'm not so makbid about davening every day, does that mean all of a sudden I'm no longer part of the Jewish people for these purposes? So we explained, based off of the Muki Yosef, based off the Rabbeinu Yonah, and based off the Chafetz Chaim, that essentially rebrands Rabbeinu Yonah but says the same thing. No, we're not talking about someone who sins, or even someone who sins frequently. We're talking about someone who sins with a certain purpose. Now, if I eat the cheeseburger because I was just really hungry, and instead of driving over to 613, there was McDonald's closer by, and I wanted to eat from there, so that's called giving in to taiva. That's not called, I think that I'm not allowed to eat kosher, that I'm allowed to eat kosher. That's called, I know that God commands me to eat kosher. I'm aware that's the wrong thing, but I gave in to temptation. But philosophically, I still believe that God commands me not to eat non-kosher. So therefore, you're still within the bounds of the Jewish people. But someone, they could pick a very small, very, quote, minor mitzvah, not doesn't have to be one of the three cardinal sins or one of the Ten Commandments. It could be just something like, let's say, wearing shatnez, wearing wool and linen together on your clothing. So if they say, I'm going to do that because in principle, shatnez makes no sense to me. I don't understand klayim. I don't get what God is going for over here. So I don't think this mitzvah should apply anymore or at all. Then that makes someone a mumar lahachis, a heretic who sins in principle. And a mumar is someone who says that instead of 613 mitzvahs in the Torah, I only believe in 612 or even less. Once someone in principle only keeps some mitzvahs but not others, it's indicative that even those other 612 mitzvahs are not being done out of service to God. Because if someone was certainly subservient to God, they would abide by all 613, regardless if they all appeal to him or not. That's what we mentioned in the Chafetz Chaim. So what comes out from this, and we quoted from Rav Binyamin Zilber in a contemporary responsa called the Uzna Dabru, where he says that since you're allowed to use Onas Devarim, there's no prohibition to use Onas Devarim towards someone who is in principle against the Torah, he says they're less than a behemoth, they're less than an animal, they're less than how Jewish law would relate to a non-Jew. Because even if biblically we are allowed to use onas devarim toward a non-Jew, at very least on a rabbinical level, the rabbi said it's not good midos, it's not the right thing to do. Technically it might not be prohibited, but it's not the moral thing. But when it comes to someone who makes a scene, who deliberately advocates against the Torah publicly, in principle, that person, there's no prohibition to speak onas devarim about them. And so what we said is, so the example we used before was a very, I guess what we call, as far as politics is concerned, a very positive example. I don't think it's politically charged to ask for someone to use person first language and say child with special needs as opposed to special needs child. So that wouldn't be relevant here. But what if there's someone who's advocating against traditional marriage? They think, and we learned this in the Chumash class 2 weeks ago, I think it was 2 weeks ago, maybe three, that in the Torah, it constitutes prostitution for a man and woman to live together without being married. So let's say someone wants you to use the term partner instead of using the term wife or husband in order to be inclusive of unions that are not sanctioned by the Torah. So we said it's possible that someone who's advocating for those prohibitions might take themselves out of the status of those who are part of Amisecha, because she'itcha b'Torah mitzvos, that they are with you in Torah mitzvos. But if someone advocates against the Torah and mitzvos that are in the Torah, even if it's only one, they remove themselves from the protection and the category of being protected by Onas Dvarim. That is what we dealt with last time. Are there any just only clarification questions? Because now we're getting to the material for today. Anything I just could clarify before we move forward?
I'm sorry, could you just repeat the last point?
Yes, the last point is, so we have a mumer lahachis, someone who sins in principle. They believe that a certain mitzvah, either God has no right to command it or makes no sense, so they're rejecting God's commandment, however you want to formulate it.
Yeah.
So someone who does that removes themselves from being she'itcha b'Torah mitzvos, with you in Torah mitzvos, because they're denying part of Torah mitzvos in principle, and they're not protected by Onas Dvarim.
Okay.
So if the case where you are offending someone is because they are propounding an ideology or they are advocating against a mitzvah, and by you using language that supports keeping the Torah, then there is no reason for you to alter your terminology. In fact, there's even an idea out there called Machzik Yidei Ovrei Avera. I didn't include any sources on it. But Machzik Yidei Ovrei Avera means that, let's say, during the seventh year, Shemitah year in Israel, you're not supposed to work the land. You see Jews working the land, and you say, ah, Yasher Koach, I hope you guys enjoy working in the field today. You're encouraging people to sin. So that's called Machzik Yidei Ovrei Avera. It's similar to Lifnei Iver Lo Sitei Michshol, not facilitating a sin. So even to condone, even to promote, to sanction with words is problematic. So it would seem, based on the sources we saw, that anyone who is in principle rejecting mitzvahs from the Torah is not protected by Onas Dvarim, which significantly limits the category of those who you are required to refrain from using Onas Dvarim. That's what it seems at this point. However, now we're getting some new material. In the response of Shevet Halevi, another contemporary response to Savers, I don't see everyone on here. If Anna's with us, she'll be happy because we're doing 20th and 21st century material now. So in the Shud Shevet Halevi, he says, actually, when it comes to Amisecha, Eshe'imcha b'Torah u'mitzvos altonohu, Yera dafka mishi yichavi nishmor v'yodea lishmor ve'eno shomer v'zem mutro no. This is referring to someone who knows how to keep the mitzvos, but decides not to anyway. However, avol ma yasa tinok shenishba, shel lomad v'lo ra, v'ein bo shom ashama shavosav kilkalo oso. What about a tinok shenishba? Literally a captive child. What that means is a captive child, we'll see in the Rambam in a moment, is someone who was not brought up on Torah and mitzvos. How could they know any better? Their parents did not send them to yeshiva day school. They didn't send them to youth groups at Agudah Shalom. They didn't get any Jewish background education. If they're not keeping the mitzvahs today, that's no fault of their own. It's simply that they never received that education. So how can we blame the child and say, you know what, now we can speak all the Onas Dvarim toward you that we want because you are not fortunate enough to receive Jewish education to know how to keep all the mitzvahs in the Torah. So the Shevet Halevi says that many of the people today who do not keep Torah mitzvos, they're not sinning in principle. And even if they do not accept the yoke of heaven, it's not their fault. It's not like they made a conscious decision. Because in order to shirk off the yoke of heaven, you have to have first been aware that you were supposed to accept it. But if someone was raised in an environment where they weren't inculcated with Judaism, then it's not a fault of their own that they weren't aware of it. So therefore, there should be an isser. You should still not be allowed to say Onas Dvarim, even about someone who is in principle not keeping the mitzvos, but in principle because they were inculcated with a secular ideology growing up. And this is not his own idea, by the way. It gets traced back. A really great source for this is in the Rambam. Many turn to the Rambam in the Mishnah Torah in order to find a precedent. So if we go back in Jewish history, again, Jewish history is not my specialty. We'll have to bring in Rabbi Zwider at some point because that's what he does his doctorate in. But in Jewish history, finish the Rambam and then I'll take questions. The Rambam, so in Jewish history, we had the Karaim. The Karaim were the Karaites. So the Karaites rejected Rabbinic Judaism, which is what we follow, Rabbinic Judaism. We follow Torah Shel Peh, the interpretation of how the rabbis understood the Bible. But the Karaites, they rejected rabbinic interpretation. So what would I say about a child who grew up in the environment of a Karaite, was born in a Karaite family, went to a Karaite synagogue. I think there's still one that exists in Jerusalem, by the way. And he never knew any better. He never learned Gemara growing up. He doesn't know Torah Shel Peh exists. How could he be blamed? We'll see how the Rambam addresses in just a moment, but let me take Phyllis's question first.
I don't remember all of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, but I do remember that there's Eva Men HaChai, which I assume is, you know, not to cause pain to an animal. So is there something in the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach that even if you don't have any Jewish background, you have just the common decency background from, you know, the Sheva Mitzvot or whatever, that you should know not to speak to hurt people, or some sort of onat zvarim embedded in those other mitzvot that everybody has?
That's a good point. So, I mean, you know, if I were to darshan for you, there is no prohibition of onat zvarim in the seven Noahide laws. However, there is a prohibition to murder someone as one of the seven Noahide laws. So it is possible, if you want to stretch it a little bit, when the rabbis say if you embarrass someone, it's like murdering them, it's possible that could fall under one of them. But you are correct that that's generally, most of the Shemitz B'nai Noach are based on common sense, though, I mean, you have to assume that believing in God is common sense, which is a philosophical debate, which we won't get into this evening. We'll assume that believing in God is a good thing for the time being, or forever. We'll go with that.
I mean, there is a responsibility. People have a responsibility without being Jewish.
Right. I mean, again, yes, there is a responsibility, but what are the parameters of that? Do we expect people to be nice, not see onas dvarim? Yes. Is there a halachic iser? Not in the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, as far as I know. Should it be included in there? Well, okay, we can take that up with God at some point later, I suppose.
Okay.
Thanks. All right. So what does the Rambam say about the Quran, about the Karaites? So he says, so when it comes to, he's talking about people who are heretics, who are outside the fold and should be treated as such. But he says, these children that were born among the Karaites, and then they were born based on Karaite ideology. They are like a captive child among them. Even of years afterwards about the laws, he doesn't know any better. So this is an important word. I probably should have bolded this as well. He is anus. He is an ones. He doesn't have an alternative. He doesn't have a choice because he's not aware of a choice. And even if he hears that there's something called rabbinic Judaism out there, you know what he's being told? He's being told those are the bad guys. So, you know, he doesn't know to think for himself. We can't expect him to think for himself. And therefore, they are still considered part of the Jewish nation for halachic purposes, not just biologically, but also they get the benefits. So, for instance, Rambam is not talking about onas dvarim here per se, but you would not be allowed to use onas dvarim towards someone who was born from the Karaites. And that is what is being applied by the Shevet Halevi. Same idea here when it comes to onas dvarim today, that many people who do not grow up observant get the status of tinok shenishba. And Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, in his response to Binyan Sion, he also uses this idea to tell us how even if a Jew is not completely Shabbos observant, they are still considered a part of the Jewish community on a halachic level to be protected by onas dvarim. And he's, because now a little background, it used to be traditional understanding until in recent centuries was that if someone violates Shabbos b'farhesi in public, then they are considered a heretic. Because what does Shabbos represent? Shabbos is where we sanctify and we signify the importance of God creating the world. And when we mark that, if we don't mark that, if we deny, if we violate Shabbos, it's tantamount to denying God as the creator of the world. And you can see how denying that God's created the world is very naturally a form of heresy, because that essentially denies all of Judaism then, if you can't agree on that point. So what happened was, though, in recent centuries, many people who are all, you know, good people, good intentions, were not keeping Shabbos, were not Shomer Shabbos. So the question is, how does halacha relate to these people who are not necessarily keeping Shabbos, but don't necessarily have a bone to pick with Judaism either? They're not doing it with any malicious intentions. It's just, you know, maybe they're working. Maybe they have a hard time balancing. They need the extra money, whatever it is. This was especially what happened. I mean, obviously I wasn't alive then, but during the earlier 20th century, that's where Moshe Feinstein says, everyone used to say, Shvir to Zion a Yid, it's tough to be a Jew. So how do we relate to that? So he says, Shabbavor v'sina ha-ramim pashta ha-va-heris la-rov ad sharu mechil Shabbos nasik a-heter. Chil Shabbos is spread so far that it became like a heter. People don't even give a second thought before being mechal Shabbos. It's like it's mutter. Im lo yeshlehem din omer mutter shrak korv le-mezitu. So here's the thing, though. It's not like they're just violating Shabbos all day. What else do they do? But at the same time, before they go drive out to work, they make sure to designate time to go to shul in the morning and to also make kiddush. They go to Ashkama Minyan, then they make kiddush, and then they drive to work. So, you know, if the basis of heresy is that by denying Shabbos, it's implicit that I'm denying God's creation of the world. If you are making Kiddush on Shabbos, it pretty much, what is the point of Kiddush? Kiddush is the signification that God is the creator of the world. That's the whole point of sanctifying the day of Shabbos. So someone is sanctifying the day of Shabbos and they go drive, that of course isn't a positive thing, but you can't say that they are a heretic for doing that, especially if they're making Kiddush, which is about marking that God is the creator of the world. By the way, quick plug, if you're interested more in Hilchos Kiddush, we made a WhatsApp group that we send out a daily halacha. We start with Hilchos Kiddush. Feel free to email me or just go on the Shul Adult Education website. You can find the link there. End of commercial break. So also just interesting to note, I didn't put the source on here, but here's put in a footnote, that Rav David Zvi Hoffman in Childs and Shuvos Malad of the Hoel, he also used the same rationale to say that someone who doesn't keep Shabbos, isn't keeping all the halachos, they can still be counted as part of a minyan. Because someone who's a heretic cannot be counted as part of a minyan, but these are not heretics. These are people who are struggling to keep Judaism and to keep afloat financially. And of course, it's ideal to be keeping Shabbos. That's what we encourage. But if they're not, it's not a statement of rejecting God's yoke of heaven. And we're not going to look at this next one inside. I guess that's our commercial break. So the Chazon Ish, I don't know where that's coming from. So the Chazon Ish says, and this is basically what everyone goes to, the go-to source. The Chazon Ish says that since nowadays we do not see the light of God in this world the way we did yesterday, we don't see open miracles, God's hashgach, his providence is not obvious to us in this world, we can't call someone a heretic for denying it. When do we call someone a heretic? When it is clear and unambiguous to us that God's providence is in this world. Back in times when I guess all these tzaddik stories actually maybe took place, and you saw nearly open miracles before your eyes. If then you had the hubris to reject God's mitzvos, then that's pretty bad. But today, where it's unclear to people, people don't see God's providence in this world so well, and if you're not a big fan of all the Hashgacha Pratis books that Art School puts out either, then we can't blame you for not necessarily believing that God is running the world. That's actually a very fascinating position. It's taken by a very Haredi rabbi, the Chazon Ish, but he's very understanding of that, which is very fascinating. So Rabbi Norman Lamb in the Zichrono Livracha, so he's, I think, Rabbi Drach, one of our previous rabbis, Rabbi Drach's father-in-law. So Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, he summarizes four reasons why today a Jew who does not abide by Torah and mitzvos does not get the status of a heretic. So number one, have fun translating this line. This is like the ultimate trying to sound intellectual line. Heretics today are coerced by the zeitgeist we live, which ineluctably affects our Weltanschauung. Translation literally into English, that means that since there's an overall culture today that has rejected God for secularism or humanism, we can't blame people who are brought up in secular society that they do not necessarily believe in God. I think that's how I would translate all that German. that's like just throwing too many words into one sentence over there. I don't know what he was going for. Anyway, if you read enough for Soloveitchik, maybe then you can understand that. Also, he says, one may be classified as a heretic only if he's rejected halakhically valid rebuke. But if you never rebuked him, you never told him what he was doing is wrong, then you can't call him an evildoer. You need to receive some form of hasra, some form of rebuke. And conveniently, many rabbis today believe we don't know how to give proper rebuke, like the Chazanish included. So rather, what are we supposed to do? We bring people in by putting an arm around them, saying, Shalom Yisrael, welcome to the community, we all love you, and we hope one day you keep Torah and mitzvos. That's a strategy many people in Kiruv take today. Then, number three, heresy in our day is most often not a positive rejection of Jewish principles of faith, but a lack of conviction or belief. So this is a statement I will take issue with, by the way. He assumes that why are people not keeping Torah today? Not because they don't believe in God, not because they reject tenets of Jewish faith, but because they're lacking faith, because they're not really sure. So that's not called heresy. Here's the thing with a lot of this literature, by the way, in Tinoch Shenishba. My Rabbi J.D. Schachter, was giving a speech on this topic. He pointed me to some of these Orthodox Forum English articles that we're looking at right now. And he said that there were a few rabbis from the Jewish Theological Seminary, the conservative rabbinical seminary, who were sitting in on his speech while he was in Tinek. So here he thought he was talking to an exclusively Orthodox audience. He was not aware. And then there was a number of conservative rabbinic intellectuals. So when he said that today, you know, we think when Orthodox rabbis dole out the term Tinoch Shenishba, I say, that guy's okay. He's part of the Jewish people. He's a Tinoch Shenishba. He's a Catholic child. He doesn't know any better. On the one hand, it's really nice because it shows we're very accommodating and inclusive. On the other hand, it's very infantilizing and it's an insult to the intelligence of all non-observant people because it assumes that all people non-observant aren't intellectually sophisticated enough to come to a conclusion other than the tenets of our faith. Not to say I'm encouraging that, but there are people who they'll study what rabbinic Judaism has, they'll study what Orthodoxy believes, and they'll come to a conclusion that's contrary to it. So that's not called me being unaware, poor me being a captive child. No, I am an educated adult making a decision based on my own intellectual analysis. So maybe it's possible that a lot of people don't think about philosophical issues on a regular basis. They don't think about theological issues. So maybe they could fall into Tinoch Shenishba. But to say like that, when he was talking, to say like that these intellectuals who were in the room with him, because they rejected the tenets of traditional Judaism, such as, I think back in the day, many people from JTS, they didn't say believed in some aspects of biblical criticism and multiple authors of the Torah, didn't say come from Sinai, etc. So to say that they don't know any better is an insult to all of their academic prowess and all of their studies that they've done over the years. So that is part of what, based on that anecdote and just my own experience, it's on the one hand, it's very nice and accommodating to call someone a Tinoch Shenishba, but it's also very infantilizing and doesn't give enough credit to those who do the research.
So in general, are they called heretics or not?
So in general, most Orthodox rabbis I talked to have a very liberal in terms of flexible understanding of Tinoch Shenishba. They kind of assume anyone's a Tinoch Shenishba, almost anyone. I personally assume, you know, if you
even
want
those intellectuals?
Right. So here's my, you know, it's possible you push an Orthodox rabbi, you sit him down, and you push him, and you ask him, what do you think of, you know, this person, this intellectual leader who rejected tenets of Judaism, what do you think about them? So they might admit it. I'll just be, you know, I don't like sugarcoating, so I'll be intellectually honest with you. I love every Jew equally, and everyone should be treated the same. But on a practical level, I have too much respect for my colleagues of different denominations to say that I consider them just simply a Tinoch Shenishba, because I think they spend all those years trying to study at least basics of Jewish theology and studying rabbinic texts to say that they're completely unaware of it. It's just an insult to all those years of study that they did. Now, does that mean that they, you know, now we have to treat them with a stricter halakhic status? That might be it. But I think, you know, I think it's a bigger insult to then just say, they're a Tinoch Shenishba, they don't know any better. No, they know the options on the table, at least enough to make an informed decision, I would think. But, you know, that's after being in like a number of different fellowships with APAC, with Shalom Hartman Institute, the UJ Federation. Like, I think, you know, that's my take on it. Anyway, and it's not only me who says this, but if you look in the Minchas Elozer, it's a similar idea there as well. We're not going to look at it inside because we have about 10 minutes left. But I want to read to you this beautiful piece by Rusalovichik. It's in, if you own the Rusalovichik Mesoros Rav Chumashim, it's in there. And he's talking about an Ir Hanidachas. He's talking about a wayward city that we have to destroy all the inhabitants in there. At very least, like the male and female inhabitants, possibly the children we don't. That's a machlokas. And we saw that also in our Sunday morning Chumash here.
Yeah, in the Parsha. Wasn't it just in the Parsha?
We had it recently. So we covered that in our Chumash here. Because we had Kisetze and all that. Right. So in that general area. So he says, the Torah can be rather tolerant of individual sins whose motives are lust and desire. The Torah knows the human being with all of his weaknesses and has a good deal of empathy for him. For I have no desire for the death of the wicked, but that he turn from his way and live, it says in Ezekiel. But when does this all apply? As long as the sin is not intermingled with ideology. If, however, a person fashions an entire ethics of sin and sanctifies the sin by applying God's name to it, he becomes the most dangerous criminal. For an ideology can be preached to others. People are rather receptive and accepting and easily influenced, etc., etc., etc. So the chilek, beautifully articulated by Rusalovichik.
It's a chilul Hashem.
Right, exactly. So when someone takes something that is usur, is prohibited in the Torah, and then not only performs the prohibition, but then tries to pervert it and make it sound like it's a mitzvah, like it's a mitzvah to serve God by doing whatever that prohibition is, that is, like Phyllis said, is a chilul Hashem. And so that's what we're primarily worried about when it comes to heresy. Not people who are sinning because, particular mitzvahs are difficult. They have work on Shabbos. They're going to get fired. Okay, we're understanding of it. Not ideal. We encourage people to keep Shabbos, but we understand the challenges of why people don't. But if someone then creates an ideology and says, you know what? We should do away with Shabbos. And to work on Shabbos is even a mitzvah commanded in the Torah to work on Shabbos rather than to rest on Shabbos. And you use God's name. Then that's a perversion of the Torah, and that there's no room for tolerance for that. And I'm not gonna go into further examples, but you can plug it into different things that you might see today, and draw those conclusions based on the principle I'm sharing. So I bring this all in because we said an exception to the rule of Onas Devarim is someone who is a heretic. What we just learned is that many people do not fall into the category of heretic because of Tinok Shenishba. However, there are a few that do. And those few who do are those who advocate in principle against mitzvos in the Torah, either against positive or negative mitzvos. Once someone is outright advocating in principle against a mitzvah in the Torah, they lose the protection of Onas Dvarim, as well as many others, as no prohibition to use a term toward them that would be offensive. Now, do we encourage people to go around using hurtful terminology? No, we do not. But I think it's important for our case that if the term you're using is found offensive because it supports adherence to the Torah and is in conflict with an ideology that is negative to the Torah, it's antithetical to the Torah, then obviously the Torah does not want you to alter your language to accommodate an ideology that's being preached against the mitzvah in the Torah. So that, to me, is very obvious from the sources, because the Torah wants us to advocate for the Torah, not to advocate against the Torah, to put it in just very simple terms. So if the case comes up that you're offending someone because you're defending the Torah, then that's actually not only mutter, but it is a mitzvah to defend and advocate the Torah. Any questions before we I have a few more sources that I'll just run through, but any questions, Haros, on this before
just
we get
sort of thoroughly confused.
So Susan, you brought up.
No, I'm just confused because keeping track of who's what.
We try not to keep too many tabs on people because I'll throw in there very quickly. A danger of this, of course, is that let's say you don't like someone. And so then next time you see him doing an aveir, you say, you're a heretic. Now it's mutter for me to do, you know, cause an us to harm to you, do all these things. Right, Lemaisa, I wouldn't advise trying to find people, trying to become an inquisitor and figuring out who the heretics are in your community. It's only, I think, when someone is, again, getting up on a soapbox and advocating against the Torah, I think that's when it's obvious you're not looking to find heresy. It's being literally preached to you. Phyllis, did you have another point, or is it the same thing as Susan?
Well, you mentioned, when we were talking about the seven Noahide laws, you mentioned, reminded me about murder. I don't know if you were speaking about actually killing somebody, or you were speaking about the fact that onat varim can be akin to murder. It's as though you committed murder. Sometimes.
I'm not sure if I understand the question.
When you insult somebody, when you yeah. shame somebody,
yeah,
it's like you're committing murder.
So when you let me just qualify them. That when you humiliate someone in public,
yes.
and yeah. You know, cause the blood to drain from them, you cause right. that form of humiliation. That is agadically mm-hmm. similar to murder. But mm-hmm. here on Asvarim, yeah. at least in our case that we're focusing on, we're not talking about public humiliation. We're more talking about you. This could even just be literally a private conversation where you use a term that another person finds offensive.
Okay, so it's the lesser of the.
Right. So the chiddush over here is that is to figure out, you know, where we draw the line. Public humiliation might be right, as you're pointing out. That might be a problem as well, though. It is possible that there are some who might even go as far to say that humiliation might be okay, but I'm not going to take that jump.
I think it's okay. Never okay.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm trying to say. Yes, we're on the same boat, Phyllis. We're in the same team here. Okay, one other thing that I just want to point out is that we've been talking about the whole time, we've been making it sound like the onus is on Reuven, right? The question is, does Reuven need to change the way he talks? But what about Shimon? Is there any onus or responsibility on Shimon? So what happens is there is an opinion in the Sma, is interpretation of the Rama, that you're actually allowed to do self-defense. So if the Sefer Chinuch says Shi'ev Shor Liyosa Adam Ke'evin She'in La Hofchem, can't just say we don't expect people to just be a rock and an island, as Simon Garfunkel once said. We don't expect you just to be silent while someone uses onas devarim to you. So if someone's using onas devarim toward you, you're allowed to verbally defend yourself b'shas maisa in the moment of that happening, similar to how you defend yourself physically. Someone physically assaulted you, God forbid. So what I find, it's just a personal observation, is that sometimes, going back to our non-political example, special needs child versus child with special needs, the person who used the term special needs child with no ill intention, that just happens to be how they formulated it, mm-hmm. sometimes the second party is so offended by the mentioning of not using person first language that they will respond by publicly humiliating the person for inadvertently using that offensive term, which ironically, it turns not Reuven into the culprit here, but really Shimon sometimes in an act of zeal goes beyond self-defense, goes on the offense to someone who never even had intention to cause any form of distress or harm to begin with. So something important to keep in mind is that there is a responsibility on Shimon's side not to escalate the conversation and not to, attack with a disproportionate strike, especially on someone who never even intended any harm. There needs to be, at least on Shimon's end, a Don Lekav Schus, needs to be some assumption of goodwill on the other end. Now, obviously, if someone uses, a racial slur, uses obviously, blatantly, flagrantly bad language, that's a different story. But over here, it's all about that gray area. And if you have no reason to assume they're trying to be offensive towards someone, to harm someone emotionally, then you're supposed to respond and, say, by the way, I think, this might be a better way to formulate things. It might be better to use person first language. But you don't need to do it in front of a room of like 50 people and try to humiliate them just so that you could feel all smug and happy about yourself that you're the morally superior person. That obviously would not make you morally superior. And one last ta'ara that I want to share is, let's just go back up to the Ramah. So this is my own, you know, you can tell me if you disagree with it. This is my own personal take. So the Ramah that we looked at before that really threw us down this whole rabbit hole is that, or again, he had this very vague formulation, someone who's ma'ana himself, you're allowed to cause onah to them. So he said maybe someone who, that's mean he caused onah to himself by not keeping God's mitzvos. That's a bit of a stretch. Yeah. But perhaps that's what he means. It's just a continuation of the first line, the Ramah, that those who aren't God-fearing are not included in the protections of onah tzvar. But something that occurred to me is sometimes today, in contemporary discourse, we do what is, I think the expression is, we clutch our pearls, or like clutch our pearl necklace, something like that, where we try to, we're not really, you know, in emotional distress, but we try to make a scene in order to, the terminology, as you say, it's virtue signaling, in order to show that you're offended, in order to make a scene, in order to feel morally superior to that first person. So that first person may have unwittingly, or I'll give you an example one time. So, right, it is sensitive in shul that when you meet, when you're counting for a minyan, you should say man, and you should say man, you should say people, because women are people. So if you're only counting men, you should say men and not people, right? So that's something that I think, at least, you know, I've heard recently you're supposed to be sensitive to. One time I saw a rabbi get up in shul. He accidentally, you know, said people instead of men. And then, like, there was a huge uproar in public against him. You know, that's something that could have been resolved by going over to him later and saying, you know, by the way, I think you should say men and not people. But if someone is going to, you know, it's very obvious. It's obvious to me that in certain cases, you know, you might be a little, I'm trying to think of the appropriate language for it, perturbed. You might be irked by something, but you're not distressed to the point of where you need to make a huge uproar and scene out of it. So what does it mean, mishima'ana es atmo? Someone who causes emotional distress themselves. That's not Reuven causing the emotional distress. That's called Shimon riling themselves up to feel the emotional distress and acting like there's been a terrible crime that's been perpetrated. And to them, we say, mutilonio, you're allowed to use that terminology because it's ridiculous that someone should, you know, accidentally use a term that doesn't necessarily agree with every single person, and that you should be able to get up there and be able to humiliate them and stop them from saying that. You go over them afterwards then. So that's what it means.
You know, what
was that, Phyllis?
In today's day and age, if that same person had said men instead of people, people would have been in an uproar over them. So they should have said people, not men, because it excludes women and other people. So you don't know today. You don't know what's the right thing.
Well, yes,
whatever you choose could be the wrong word.
Right. So there's many things that could be the wrong word, and I think, you know, it's important if we find ourselves on the end where we find something to be offensive to us. It's important to figure out, you know, is this person, you know, if they call someone, God forbid, like the N-word, or use something that's flagrantly a negative and provocative term, then obviously they have bad intentions. But if someone uses a term that is not malicious, but just not preferred, and we get that feeling of zealousness that we want to stamp our foot down and make a scene out of it, that's not necessarily the appropriate way to react either. So my conclusion, and I'll take any other questions if there are any, is that there is two sets of responsibilities. There's a responsibility on the speaker to try to anticipate normal things that people might feel are insensitive of him to say, and to try to use appropriate language. But it's also incumbent upon a second party to realize that everyone has their own idiosyncrasies. Everyone is like a tinok shinishpat, so to speak. We're all brought up in our own different environments, exposed to different family members, different schools, different communities, different political ideologies. And to assume the best in people, that when they're speaking to you, they're not trying to rile you up. They're not trying to get a reaction out of you. Some people are like that, unfortunately. Most people are not. And to just be civil toward one another and assume the best in each other. If we could do that, I think then that is the ideal way to have discourse, even if we come from different walks of life. And even if we have different ideologies, ultimately that's a way to bridge the gap and for us to heal this shattered world that we live in today. So thank you all for coming to this four-part series
that
we had on Onas Devarim. Again, if you missed any classes, you want to just hear the others, most of my classes are uploaded to YU Torah. You can either find that link by searching my name, Moshe Kurtz from YU Torah, or go to the Agudah Shalom website and find a link over there. So thank you all for learning today.
Thank you so much.
What was that, Toby?
Yeah, I did it today. I heard the first one.
Oh, okay, great. So Toby was our first customer.
I didn't realize how many I had missed.
Well, you can teach us.
Okay. So there you all go.
What's next?
So next week we're going to do a Rosh Hashanah topic. We're going to talk about Hataras Nedarim. And we're going to talk about the topic of how Hataras Nedarim works. Can a woman, does she appoint her husband to do it for her? We're going to talk about not just women, because I feel like any issue, you just want to make a contemporary issue, you talk about the difference between women and men. So that's like a cheap shot. We're going to get into the intricacies of how Hataras Nedarim works, annulling our vows before Yom Tov. What is the significance of Kol Nidre? It's going to be less of a, controversial, hot topic, but it'll be a very timely and relevant topic in preparation for Rosh Hashanah. So there's your preview for next week. Be'ezus Hashem, looking forward to learning with all of you, and have a wonderful evening.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you so much. Good night, everybody.